from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Hi, everybody. This is Jason Rosenbaum, a politics correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. It didn't take long for Dara Eskridge and Aaron Williams to spring into action after a deadly tornado ripped through parts of North St. Louis. Eskridge and Williams helped lead the For the Ville Hub, which provided critical supplies and housing stabilization to people throughout North St. Louis. Both Eskridge and Williams have deep ties to the community. Eskridge is the CEO of Invest STL, which helps financially support neighborhood development initiatives. And Williams is president of For the Ville, a nonprofit group that aims to preserve and expand the rich cultural history of the North St. Louis neighborhood. The hub shut down earlier this month, but during a conversation with me last week, Eskridge and Williams reflected on the volunteer effort's impact and how they plan to keep the assistance coming to tornado victims. Here's my conversation with Dara Eskridge and Aaron Williams. So, Aaron, can you talk about the For the Ville Emergency Hub and what prompted you and many others to set it up after the tornado?
So, prior to the tornado, For the Ville was conducting a corridor planning process for Dr. Martin Luther King, trying to work with the community to envision what the future of MLK could be as the spine of a reinvigorated community around the commercial corridor. Part of that planning process included us opening an info center for residents and other community members to drop in and get updates on the planning process. So that info center is what became the emergency response hub after the tornado. The day of the tornado, I was actually presenting awards to Sumner graduates at their graduation. So I had just left the neighborhood heading over to Harris Stowe for the graduation. And just after leaving, I was informed that a tornado ripped through the neighborhood. So that evening, I took a ride to assess the damage. And after doing that, I made a decision that I needed to go out there as the representative of a community organization and work with our neighbors, our community members to try to triage the damage. So the day after the storm, I basically set up a chainsaw crew, and we were going about the neighborhood helping people clear roads so that they can get to whatever resources they needed. And because of the relationships I have, let me add also that with mobilizing the chainsaw crew, Dara, who I have a very close relationship with, obviously, as a friend, but also a partner in this work, reached out and asked how she could support. So she was also part of the chainsaw crew, but I'll let her speak for her story. After that first day, we started getting inquiries from other people about how they can support what we were doing. So we simply told them to meet us at the info center. And after so many people began meeting us at the info center, that turned into other people dropping off resources, and it evolved into the emergency response hub that we managed for 3 weeks.
Dara, I'm interested to hear how you were part of this chainsaw crew, but I also want to know how Invest STL helped with this effort, because if Invest STL is involved with like fundraising and getting money for certain things, to say this would be a Herculean endeavor would be the understatement of the year in terms of getting the resources needed for the affected area. So I'd like you to elaborate on your involvement with this.
So as Aaron alluded, like being part of the chainsaw crew was much more about, you know, just individual relationships and people coming together. And so, yeah, we were out there raking and cutting and clearing. But then certainly the next day became much more about a formal operation, where it now became about the organization that I represent also being in this in partnership with For the Ville and Action St. Louis and then eventually Dream Builders for Equity and other organizations. Some is kind of essential backstory is that this spring, Invest STL and For the Ville and Northside Community Housing had just initiated a multi-year investment partnership focused around the Ville, Greater Ville, and Kingsville East neighborhoods. And so this really was like a very energized activation of that relationship in real time. And so when it became clear that our partners who are based in that community wanted to stand up a full recovery operation, we leveraged the assets of our organization, including our own staff, to be able to do that. And so it effectively worked out to like Aaron with For the Ville and then Dream Builders running the debris and tarping kind of stabilization work, and then Invest STL running the recovery supply side, the operation side of that hub.
And Dara, for people who may not have gone to parts of North St. Louis where the tornado hit, can you just describe what you and other people in this emergency hub saw with your own eyes? And just also describe the enormity of what you had to do over the past couple of weeks.
When I think back to, the first moment that I was kind of going through the neighborhoods, it was actually on the 16th because I live on the north side and I was coming from a meeting in North County and I had to take the streets. So I ended up having to drive, through Penrose and O'Fallon, Fairground to get to my neighborhood. And frankly, the first kind of feeling that came to me was absolute heartache, right? The North Side is a chosen place for me. It's a place that I have very fond memories of growing up. And I think a lot of people who we saw at the hub share that sentiment, right? This is a place that they love, that is endearing for them. And we're immediately met with this question of what's going to become of this place that we've loved so much after the just incredible devastation that has come. But then quickly answers started to come up where people started forming, right? They started organizing. Aaron put out a call and asked people to join a chainsaw crew and then said, meet me at an info center. And the volume of people that grew day by day was incredible. It was really an image of a community coming to serve and tend to itself. So I think that's kind of like the immediate of what we saw. And then, as time went on over the weeks, you certainly see these notes of resiliency, right? People being very committed to this place and wanting to stay in these communities and being optimistic that answers and the resources that they needed to rebuild would come, but also being very vigilant in that they weren't leaving this place because they know what could happen if they're not, keeping watch over their communities.
Aaron, as far as like just people that were volunteering for this, did you have to do very much to get people to help over the past couple of weeks? Or was it just sort of a spontaneous burst of volunteerism that took maybe even took you by surprise?
So I wouldn't call it a spontaneous burst of volunteerism, nor would I call it a like a challenge to bring in volunteers. I think that this entire mobilization was rooted in relationships. So our relationships span quite broadly across different industries and different efforts within the community. So once our partners, community partners and friends, realized that we were on the ground and we had like a central location to organize, they just started galvanizing around us. We didn't have to ask them, nor were we ever overwhelmed with, I guess, volunteerism that needed particular steering, or coaching. We were all in relationship. We all serve these communities, work with these communities, live in these communities. So we understood the assignment. And all we needed was a place to gather and begin to organize with each other.
I'll throw this open to either one of you. Can you just sort of talk about the actual impact? Like, how many people did you give food and supplies to? How many tarps did you put on people's homes? What was the quantifiable impact of your work?
Yeah, I'll start because I want to add a bit to my last statement too. Just acknowledging some of the particular partners that quickly galvanized around this. So first and foremost, Action St. Louis and For the Culture STL up at the O'Fallon Rec Center. Again, that was immediately a synergistic relationship. It's like, what are y'all doing down there? What are y'all doing up there? How can we organize this better? But also, I come from the general contracting community. So there was an immediate connection made with larger contractors, and McCarthy supported us a lot with the construction material and any other types of equipment and supplies that we needed on our site to serve in the capacity that we wanted to serve. Also, have a leadership role, both Dara and I, in Urban Land Institute. So they supported us as well in this effort. And I'm speaking to those two specifically because they're sort of outside of this community network that we're part of. They will be organizations or groups that you wouldn't assume would show up. But because of our relationships, they too answered the call and supported us in that effort. So with that support, what were we able to accomplish? I'll speak to the construction or stabilization work, and I'll let Dara speak to the like drive up, walk up support. So with the construction crew, we boarded and tarped over 360 homes collectively between For the Ville and Dream Builders, or we were sort of I guess maestroing the effort, but it was a number of contracting companies and walk-up skilled labor that supported us in that for a total of 360 plus homes that were temporarily stabilized.
And then in terms of, you know, households that we interacted with and provided household care supplies and personal care supplies, meals, and also just connections to other resources, we were looking by the time we closed, approaching 4,500 households. And that only includes people that like we have paperwork for. We also interacted with a lot of families just out in the neighborhoods as our teams were canvassing and, you know, handing out supplies as we came across distinct needs like, you know, the Ville went without power for a very long time. So we had a crew out there handing out flashlights and taking charging stations and taking water. So I'd say 4,500 is like probably the baseline, but far more than that.
Absolutely. And I think we had just over 600 volunteers to come through and support us in our efforts through the 3 weeks.
So when both me and my colleagues have talked with residents who have had their homes damaged or destroyed by the tornado, they are so grateful to groups like yours and Action St. Louis and the countless other groups that stepped up to help. They also have said, we wish that the governments had done this and hadn't like given or put the onus on volunteers for the initial phase. We're going to talk about how that's changing, but given that you are the volunteers people are talking about who they wished were not like primarily responsible for some of the first level response, I'd be interested in both of your takes on that because on the one hand, I could understand that sentiment, but on the other hand, there's a lingering distrust of government that goes back decades, if not centuries. So maybe this was the better option.
So one, I would say, no matter the level of government organization, our relationships and our commitment to this community means that we were going to be out there no matter what. Now, because there wasn't really an organized playbook for this instance, we showed up in ways that were maybe not very typical for us and caused us to stretch and allowed us to kind of stand in the gap while government got, you know, their footing. But still, no matter what, we were going to be out there. I think it is maybe more useful to just look at what have we learned over these 3 weeks between, you know, self-organized, self-deployed, and government infrastructure to see what can we apply forward, right? Because I think the solution for the long term rests in the middle. We need highly organized government to shepherd resources, to leverage, you know, the workforce of city government, especially when it comes to like forestry and building division and those entities, right? They have to be the ones who are coordinating state and federal resources and participation, right? Nobody else can step in that gap. So really making sure that from the government side, that we're really clear on what that playbook looks like for the future, right? So we know who needs to make the call, what needs to be requested, who needs to be coordinating between these different government levels. But then at the hyper local level, the neighborhood level, I think it is absolutely beneficial that you do have these community-based organizations who are ready to be able to respond immediately because they have the closest relationships in the neighborhoods. And so what has really crystallized for me, and I think for both of us in this moment, is that there are core functions that community-based organizations like CBCs and other ones like For the Ville, they have to be able to serve in a response nature when these kinds of incidences happen, right? They need to have access to a facility that allows them to organize supplies and volunteers. They need a staging area. They need adequate staff to be nimble in a moment like this. And they need to have a direct line to local government so that they can relay information and resources down to the resident and business owner level.
I would agree with that. The biggest lesson learned here is that an ideal system for emergency response is one that fully integrates CBOs and city government functions. And I think from my own observations, that has been one of the biggest lessons, is that if there were a playbook for CBOs and city government to begin coordinating immediately, then the system or the safety net will be stronger and more resilient. And in some ways, we were almost there, or we got there, just by nature of responding to the need. It may have been a little bit clumsy, but I think that's part of the figuring out process when it's new to everyone. I just want to harken back to some histories. For the Ville, like I said, we operate at the intersection of cultural heritage, history, and community development. What that means is that we're always looking to history for a source of inspiration or wisdom in how we address an opportunity or need. In 1927, September of 1927, this same community went through the exact same thing. And you can pull articles on newspaper.com where groups like the American Red Cross were, I guess, grateful and in acknowledgement of the community's ability to organize rapidly and take care of itself. 1927, Sumner High School and Poro College immediately mobilized into action, putting cots inside of Poro, feeding and housing 5,000 people. National Black organizations and local Black organizations like the Argus and the Associated Colored Press immediately stood up fundraisers to pull money into St. Louis to support the victims of the 1927 tornado. This is all deja vu. We are literally walking in the shadow of those ancestors, and the city response was probably very similar. That's why when you look through newspapers, you see the same COAD, VOAD organizations that were present then. But what history tells us, or what archives tell us, is that the community responded the exact same way, and it was an essential function of the response effort.
I want to talk about where you all are going forward, because we're clearly in a different phase of the recovery effort, especially with FEMA coming on board, with the state giving money, with some of the RAMS money possibly going to the recovery effort. What I read yesterday is your group is going to be embarking on a number of initiatives, one of which is direct cash assistance to people that need it. If either one of you wants to talk about how that's going to work and how much money you're going to need for this to be effective, the floor is yours.
So what we understand as every day, we get new information as a community. There are at least 1,300 households whose homes have been deemed, structurally unsafe, right? And so leaving them with few options. And while we, I think, are all applauding the FEMA and National Disaster Declaration, we know that that's not really a fast system, right? So it will be some time before resources start flowing to people who need it most. And so the direct cash assistance is meant to be something that can be more immediate and far more flexible than most government programs can be to get people the kind of cash that they need to make the decisions that they need to make for themselves to be well in this moment. It's not, it's not long-term rebuilding funding right now, it's like, what are the immediate emergent needs that are coming up for a household that they need to tend to? And so we are looking at $3,000 per effective unit that they can use as they need to use, right? So they can use it to find temporary housing. They can use it to get that tarp put on because they haven't been able to get it done yet. They can use it, to get childcare so that they can tend to cleaning up the house in the moment. Whatever helps them start to rebuild their lives, that is what those dollars can be used for. And so we're projecting that, we need at least $4 million to really be able to serve the full need as we understand it today. And we're working very quickly to stand that program up so that we can start being proactive in reaching out to those households who have received that red sticker designation from the city.
And can you talk also about like where this money is going to come from? Is it going to be primarily private money? And how confident are you that you'll be able to get the money that you need?
So this is all private funding coming from individuals, corporations, and foundations. Some of the partners include John S. McDonough Foundation, Missouri Foundation for Health, Wells Fargo, Boniface Foundation, as well as a host of individual donors. And so we'll continue to grow the fund in that way. Right now, today, we are sitting at about 1.6 million towards that 4 million, and that's really without a major fundraising push. And so we will initiate the real fundraising push essentially today. And I'm confident that we can get to the 4 million. There's a lot of generosity and care and attention to this moment. And I think a lot of entities and families and organizations have been waiting for something that they can, support that is around direct cash assistance.
And Dara, the fund that is going to be paying for this direct assistance, is it going to be coming from private money? Is it going to be coming from elsewhere? Can you just sort of talk about where the funds are coming from?
These are all privately funded. So these are corporations and foundations, individual donors. And so already we have James S. McDonough Foundation, Missouri Foundation for Health, Boniface, among others who have contributed. We are seeking to raise $4 million to meet the need that we see right now. And we are about 1.6 million towards that goal.
And Aaron, since you are kind of more of an expert on the general contracting side, I read that some of the efforts to board up windows or to put tarps on people's houses, they're not going to stop, but because there's now a centralized hub for a lot of those things that is being run by the city, it's certainly going to change. Can you sort of talk about where that stands?
Part of the result of us organizing so quickly and building systems that at least worked in the short term is that the city also collaborated with us to build out their longer term systems for the triage effort or the recovery effort. So we've been coordinating with the city to build out their platform or program for the boarding and tarping. And there is a bit of a transition as we shut down like this major volunteer effort and they move to more of a contracted effort. But it will mirror the same program that we were operating out of our emergency response hub, where subcontractors are assigned to specific buildings to go complete a scope of work that's defined by whoever is managing the process. And I'm grateful that the city was willing to listen to us and how we built out that process, and they adopted most of it as long as it fit within whatever limitations they may have had.
I think another thing that you all are going to be doing is advising the city what to do from now on, because it seems like they're going to be taking a more active organizing role in the recovery efforts. You don't have to share all the advice that you've given them, but what are some things that you want the city to target as soon as possible?
I start us one, getting really clear about what the organizational infrastructure looks like. So kind of like what we were talking about before, being clear, like, yes, there are pieces that local city government has to do. They're going to need very strong, dedicated partners in these neighborhoods who have long relationships there. So clarifying those roles, and then fortifying those organizations so that they can serve in that role. The very immediate thing is also like really paying attention to supporting people in securing their property. There's so many sharks in the water right now, right? There's already the grabs for taking land and property and trying to trick people out of what is theirs. And so being proactive as a local government, ensuring that people have their deeds and that, you know, they are protected on their property, and then kind of aligned with that, as we've seen so many of our neighbors, you know, take up temporary housing on their own land by living in their cars or living in tents, getting them secure housing either on their property or very, very near their property, because they're not going to want to leave. And so I think those are some of the more immediate things. But then, of course, at a more global level, it's like really paying attention to what does a community-driven and informed rebuilding process and set of strategies look like. You know, we certainly want, you know, the support of the full region in that rebuilding process, but it's got to be the people who have been there really setting the vision for what that looks like, because this still has to be a place that belongs to the North Side and doesn't, you know, change and become some other image overnight.
And Aaron, beyond just answering my first question, I think that something a lot of us reporters are paying really close attention to is making sure there's a rebuilding process, but not a rebuilding process where people then move into homes they can't afford or they're taxed out of their homes after they're repaired. That has to probably be a long-term thing that a lot of people are paying attention to, especially because of some of the people that I've talked to who've lived in their homes for decades and maybe on a fixed incomes, their property taxes go way up. They're in a lot of trouble staying in their home.
I think what's key to all of this is, as Dar already noted, fortifying those community-based organizations that are closest to the people affected by the storm. I think that allows the city to get information through more efficiently and more clearly, which protects people from any risks that may be sort of lurking. But it also allows whatever this rebuilding effort that's shaping up, it allows it to be one that is like community driven and authentic to those that are affected. Our CBOs are adjacent to the people that live and experience this community. And a lot of us understand both sides, right? We understand this lived experience, and we also understand this very bureaucratic or practical or clinical approach to this work to get the city back to where it's going. And we have to be supported in that capacity in order to allow the city to do its work the most effectively.
I think that, you know, your question around taxes and people being priced out of a community that they've been in for a long time is an important one that we need to be looking at and planning for. But I think before we get there, the bigger question is around what does it mean to make people whole? You know, these are neighborhoods that have been drastically undervalued for generations. If you're uninsured, you're gonna get, what is it, like $86,000 from FEMA. You probably are living in a house that before the tornado was valued at, you know, as low as in just a few thousand dollars and, you know, not much more than, you know, maybe about $100,000. So we already have a system where people weren't gonna be made whole. So we really have to think about what is the true value of what people have lost, and how do we resource them so that they can begin rebuilding their lives? And that comes before we start thinking about the taxation piece.
That was Dara Eskridge and Aaron Williams talking about relief efforts for victims of the May 16th tornado. For all of our coverage about St. Louis's recovery after that natural disaster, make sure to check out our website at stlpr.org. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, and thank you for listening. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio, this is Politically Speaking.